From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We owe it to the 563,000 people who signed petitions. We owe it to the contributors. We owe it to the thousands of volunteers to try to do everything we can to get this on the ballot and not give up.
What we want to do now is learn from that and come up with something that's simple, clean, and pristine. That's what this is. Cleaner and cleaner, okay? You got the message there?
We got the message, but did advocates of changing how Illinois' legislative districts are drawn get the message from the Illinois Supreme Court? Meanwhile, there's continuing fallout from the ongoing unnatural disaster known as the Illinois State Government Budget. We'll talk about that and much more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. With me in studio in Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield and a longtime State House observer. Also here, Jamie Dunn, the editor of Illinois Issues. And on the line from Chicago is Tony Arnold, who covers state politics for WBEZ Public Radio. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we heard at the top of the show some tape from two advocates of REMAP reform, one a longtime advocate, one a seemingly relatively newer advocate of that. One was the head of the Independent Maps Group. Tony, you covered what their latest move is. Of course, last week, the Illinois Supreme Court turned down their attempt to put this question on the ballot. Where are they going now?
Yeah, that voice was Dennis Fitzsimons, who is a business leader in Chicago and has been around and is leading this group called Independent Maps. It's full of which the group itself is a formal group with committees and everything, and they have it's full of business leaders all around Chicago.
So they've collected a lot of money on this too, right? Yeah,
they've collected a lot of money, raised a lot of money to collect signatures, to hire lawyers, to write the language that they came up with to change the Illinois Constitution, and then inevitably to pay the lawyers' bills for the lawsuit that ended up coming down against it that was ultimately successful here. And so this week, because Independent Maps lost, and it looks like Illinois voters won't be voting on redistricting in November at least, they did a formal ask of the Supreme Court to, the best way I can say it is say, like, are you sure?
It's called a motion for rehearing, I think is the technical term for it, but yeah.
Yeah, and it's, all it does is just say, hey, we think you should, there's some things that you didn't address in your opinion when you struck down our a change to the Constitution, So we want you to think about it and then grant us a rehearing or something like that to let us, try to address some issues that you didn't address in your opinions. They acknowledged right up front, this is a long shot. The Supreme Court very rarely grants these types of motions or hearings or anything like that. And in all likelihood, this would be the end of this effort for at least the 2016 election year.
So, Charlie, you wrote about this topic this week for Illinois Issues, and this is, as Tony said, rehearing is pretty unlikely that something like this would happen. One of the complaints we have heard from people, though, is that the Supreme Court didn't give enough of a roadmap for how we can do this in the future.
I would say if you look at it historically, the Illinois Supreme Court, as many other courts do, reviewing courts, decides cases as narrowly as possible. And in this particular case, the challenge to the Independent Maps proposal laid out, I forget, like a dozen reasons why this doesn't pass constitutional muster. And the circuit court judge who heard the case initially agreed with them on virtually every one of those. The Supreme Court said one issue was dispositive, the fact that the proposed amendment would inject the Auditor General into the process as initially someone who would vet people who were going to be on a review panel that would pick the actual people who drew the map. And then he would be the one who would collect applications, or she would be the one who collected applications from would-be commission members. And then there was a kind of convoluted process where the legislative leaders get to knock off some of the names, and then there's a random draw for the majority of the people on the commission. But the bottom line, in the Supreme Court's opinion, the majority opinion written, subscribed to by the four Democratic members, was that the window to amend the Constitution by petition is very narrow by design of the Constitutional Convention delegates. And when you involve the Auditor General, he's outside the scope of that window. And so therefore, as they said, this issue is dispositive, which is a way of saying we only have to decide this. We're not going to get into the other areas because we want to be as narrow as possible in our opinion. On the other hand, in the dissent, Justice Carmeier, who wrote the lead dissent, addressed every one of the issues raised by the opponents to the proposal and in essence said, nope, you were wrong. And the circuit court judge was wrong when they granted your motion on this particular point. So he addressed everything and found that the petition was perfectly fine, the drive.
So, of course, but that was the minority opinion
was,
there. So that's not
it was
necessarily
a decision,
right? So,
and I'm not surprised that the court would rule on just one issue because historically the Supreme Court does not go beyond what they need to do. And also, as an aside, I appreciate Mr. Fitzsimons' angst, if you will, over the fact that a lot of money was spent, a lot of hours were put in. We had 563,000 signatures. But in the eyes of the Supreme Court, that stuff is all irrelevant. All that counts is what are the words on this petition that people signed, and does this wording fit within this very narrow category of what kind of changes to the Constitution can be proposed by the voters?
Well, Charlie there said that they characterized this as a narrow window through which we can get these kind of changes through. Somebody who came out this week and said he had a lean, mean plan that could maybe slide through that narrow window was Pat Quinn, former Illinois governor. We also heard him at the top of the show. Jamie, what does he think he has to offer in this debate?
He would expand the Supreme Court's role in redistricting, and his argument is they already have a role. So if we just build upon that, that would be constitutional, and they would be the ones actually picking this panel. There have definitely been folks who have said, not sure that that would fly, that it may go too far in expanding their role, and again, not fit in this very narrow window for citizens' initiative that we have in Illinois.
All right, so that's probably enough to say about something that does not seem to be going anywhere anytime particularly fast in Illinois this week. Unless, Charlie, you want to get one more thing in on this?
I was going to say, in a sense, it's not the end of the road. I would think there's money there to do this. This effort is something that Governor Rauner could bankroll, you know, out of his petty cash. And if they're serious about it, they could try next year because the timing isn't critical at this juncture. We won't do another redistricting until after the 2020 census. So in 2018, another effort could be made with a more appropriate change in terms of how we're going to do redistricting. And one of the things I thought might be possible is involve something or someone that's not mentioned anywhere else in the Constitution. You could say, for example, the
King of Spain.
No, I was going to say leading academics in the area of demographics, geospatial imagery, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Or you could say, as proposed by law. There's a lot of places in the Constitution where the framers said, we're creating this board and the particulars will be worked out by the General Assembly. Now, there was a lot more faith in the General Assembly back in 1970, probably, than there is today.
Well, isn't that it? I mean, we're trying to, and I don't want to get too deep down a philosophical road here, but we're trying to make something sort of less political, which is inherently has to go through a political process in order to get done.
Well, and the argument at the convention is we trust the legislature to propose amendments as needed everywhere else in the Constitution. But because lawmakers are human beings, the one area we don't think that they would really get into would be things that affect themselves directly. And they would specifically mention things like going to single-member districts, which in fact we did in 1980 through the only citizen initiative that made it to the ballot, changing from a bicameral legislature with a House and a Senate to a unicameral legislature like Nebraska has, where there's just one chamber. They said these are the things that lawmakers probably wouldn't do on their own, so we'll allow citizens to do this.
All right. Well, I'm sure we will be talking about this again someday soon. Tony, there was a lawsuit that had been pending in Chicago about social service funding for the state of Illinois. We've seen a lot of Illinois spending continue, even in the absence for almost a full year of no official state budget, in part because of a lot of court action. This was another group of people who had been trying to sort of get a piece of that action. Can you update us on what happened this week?
Yeah, I think it's I think it's always interesting that as a political reporter, I feel like I spend more time in court following different court cases than I do following politics anymore. And so this is another lawsuit. You know, we go from one lawsuit, the redistricting, to another here with the social services. And this is, you know, this social service organization, this is 100 social services around the state. Some are nonprofit, some are for-profit, that all came together and just formed one coalition to file one big lawsuit suing the state of Illinois over basically the budget impasse. And this is just part of the fallout of what happens when there's no budget for a year. And they basically said, look, we had contracts with the state of Illinois to do work for the state. We did that work. And now you guys haven't paid us. So pay up. And they asked a Cook County judge to force the state to pay them. We're talking about millions of dollars here. It'd be very expensive, and the state argued, okay, yeah, you did that work, but the state argued several things. But one of the big things was, look, in every contract it says subject to appropriation, and when that, what that really means is, if the legislature doesn't appropriate the money, doesn't pass a budget, then we're not violating the contracts by not paying you. And I think that this lawsuit, this has come around a few different ways, but because things kept changing, it was so fluid. And really, I think the stopgap budget actually kind of changed the outcome of this lawsuit, where now the stopgap does send some money to these organizations that are suing the state of Illinois. It's not all of it, but it's some of it. And it's still being worked out, even as we speak today. Who's getting what? Who's getting how much money? And the Cook County judge decided this week that he said that this is really, there's some interesting legal issues going on in here. I'm going to make a decision and leave it up to the appellate court, who inevitably is going to get this because some organization is going to sue, going to appeal. And so I'm not going to really weigh in on the legal issues. I'm just going to say, state of Illinois, you're right. You don't have to pay anything beyond what you've already agreed with the legislature and the governor's already agreed to pay. And social services lost. And the outcome of this is kind of two different things. One is that social services are kind of saying, well, now this calls into question any contract anybody has with the state of Illinois. Does anybody who has a contract, does the state not have to pay them? This Cook County judge's opinion, we think, says that the state doesn't. So that's bad business for the state government right there. And then the other thing, I guess, is just seeing who does appeal this decision and takes this further up the chain here, because it's almost 100 social service organizations. One of them is run by the governor's wife, First Lady Diana Rauner. And, you know, when you have 100 organizations, each one might make a different decision for continuing to the lawsuit or not. So we'll see how many stick around for that.
Yeah, and spending their precious dollars, which they're not getting from state government, as you said, fighting in court.
Yeah. Right. And the other thing I guess I'd say is that, you know, so much of the state budget has been done by a judge. This is one of the few rulings that actually went in favor of the state not having to pay more than it already budgeted for, because you have so many other judges that a judge said that the state had to pay employees to keep working. Another judge there's been several judges weighing in on different consent decrees saying foster care must be paid for, Medicaid must be paid for, and on and on. So a lot of judges have weighed in on this, and this is one of the first times I think that I've seen in the last year here, and all the times that the state's been sued, which has been a lot, that that the state actually won its legal arguments for not paying the full amount.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point, Tony, because that is something that personally I found rather stunning that, you know, even though, as we heard here, the state constitution, you know, things are subject to appropriation. Only the legislature can make appropriations. But so much money enabled by a handful of judges, particularly regarding state employee pay, has really in part helped or enabled at least this budget crisis to go on for as long as it has, because the state did not appear to shut down for the average Illinoisan who could get their license renewed or you know, see the state police patrolling the highways, that sort of thing.
And one of the legal issues that came up was the attorneys for the state said, "Judge, if you do this, if you make the state pay, then A, you're basically declaring that the governor is not able to veto a budget or veto a bill. You're gonna be directly overriding the governor's own override own veto of a bill, and that would set a bad precedent." And then the other thing that the judge brought up himself is like, you want me to force the state to spend money? Where's the funding for that come from? I don't have this as a Cook County judge. I don't have a say over the state, how much money the state of Illinois has to spend. So where's that funding even going to come from? I don't have that authority. Now, that hasn't stopped other judges from saying, well, Illinois, find that money because you're going to have to pay this. But it, that was the argument in this case.
Well, and I would make the point, the question of the judge saying, I can't order them to pay because they don't have the money. I suspect if the case reaches the Illinois Supreme Court, that would not be an issue. It would be more on the merits. And the question is, are these contracts valid or not? And the Supreme Court has ruled on a different issue involving back pay for workers that you can't spend, or you can't pay them without an appropriation authorizing it. And my guess is, had the St. Clair County judge's decision ordering or allowing state employees to be paid, had that been appealed ultimately to the Supreme Court would have found, no, you can't do it without appropriation. And the thing is, we're like in uncharted territory because we've never had this kind of situation before. We've always had a budget. The governor vetoing, the governor would not sign the contracts knowing who's going to veto the appropriation. And so this is just kind of a bizarre sideshow brought on by this dysfunction in terms of our leaders being unable to get together to do what needs to be done, make spending cuts, raise more revenue.
And as you said, Charlie, it wasn't appealed by Attorney General Lisa Madigan, who would have that responsibility, because really nobody wants to be the one who takes the blame. And we even saw Governor Rauner making noises about, boy, I hope Attorney General Lisa Madigan might be looking at appealing this. She's gonna shut down state government, right?
Yeah,
I mean, nobody wants to get the blame.
The governor,
for that.
From my perspective, the governor is a very good campaigner, and it's politics all day, all the time, 24/7. And at some point, he's going to, I hope, decide, okay, now we put the politicking aside and we'll sit down and we'll do what we need to do to work out a compromise. I'll get something, I'll give something. And the legislative leaders, too, are going to have to come to this conclusion that we have to, for the good of the state, we have to knock off this kindergarten nonsense, standing in the playground, you know, calling each other names, and do something for the good of the people. And the longer we go without reaching this resolution, the more difficult it becomes, because the deeper, as has been said, the deeper the hole that we're digging ourselves.
And social service agencies, Jamie, are particularly deep in the hole, a lot of them right now. You've talked to some advocates this week about, you know, the fallout from this and how the state budget is, you know, where do things stand now? Where are they going? What are their concerns?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that money that was approved, what, in June, they're just now, some providers are starting to get some of that cash. So, you know, quite a delay there. And it's only certain folks who are getting it, and it's not all that they are owed by any means. And, you know,
when you say approved in June, some of that's for money for stuff that, you know, I mean, they've been doing work for the state for even a year before that.
Yeah. So, and you know, Tony kind of made a point that I want to highlight is that this stuff isn't covered by Medicaid. It's not covered by consent decrees. And because it doesn't fall under those requirements that the state, you know, fund this under a consent decree, and it doesn't bring in Medicaid matching dollars from the federal government, these are the areas of state government that we've seen since the recession just cut and cut and cut over and over again. So they were already in a very weak position before this happened.
Yeah, and part of the problem, it's like there's two issues here. One is the spending authorized? And secondly, is the money there to pay for the spending? It'd be like me saying to my kids, oh, I'm going to give you an allowance of $1,000 a week, and I don't have that money.
Yeah, but to that, Charlie, these groups would like to see that authorization even if the money isn't there so that they have that legal authority and they get in line for the money when the money presumably comes someday.
Hope springs eternal. This is State Week. Our panel is Charlie Wheeler, Jamie Dunn of Illinois Issues, and Tony Arnold of Chicago Public Radio Station WBEZ. I'm Brian Mackey. Well, Chicago has been the site of a grim milestone in August. There were 90 murders recorded in the city. That's said to be the deadliest month in about 2 decades. Tony, this has certainly been an issue that's been on a lot of the politicians' minds in the city.
It has. Its shootings have been up and across the city for the entire year, and we're looking at not just the month of August, but this whole 2016. We're already at a lot of the shootings of the whole previous years combined, like already at where we were in 2015. This has caused a lot of different political reactions. Donald Trump last week was on national TV saying that he knows somebody in Chicago who said that he could fix Chicago crime in a week. That caused all sorts of issues about the superintendent of police saying, well, if you have a solution, obviously we need to hear it, so don't keep it a secret. Well, Donald Trump hasn't said what that is, and it just kind of raised the profile of the city to the national campaign. And then that took on a different form over the weekend, not quite a week ago now, where the cousin of the Chicago Bulls star Dwayne Wade was murdered while pushing a stroller in Chicago, and Trump sent a tweet out saying, acknowledging that incident and saying, you know, just what I've been saying, African Americans will vote Trump. And even that caused a lot of criticism most recently from Dwayne Wade himself, who said that this it looked like it was being done for political gain. And he was in his interview, I think with ABC, he was kind of wrestling with this, saying, look, I want Chicago's violence to be highlighted in a national way. People need to be getting involved and paying attention to it. But this in particular felt like it was being used for political gain. And then on a more local political level, you have Governor Rauner being asked about bringing in the National Guard to Chicago because Father Michael Flager of St. Sabina's Church on the south side of Chicago saying that the National Guard was needed. Rauner saying that that wasn't appropriate. He thought it sounded like an emotional response, but not necessarily a practical one. This is an issue that comes up, seemingly to me, every summer, of whether the National Guard, whether the state should be getting more involved. That it's been going on since I've been around for at least 10 years, and obviously it's never happened. And I guess the third thing the third political element of these consequence of all these shootings is the superintendent of police, Eddie Johnson, has picked up the call from his predecessor, Gary McCarthy, about what policies can be done to address street violence, and he's calling for mandatory minimums, which is just a fancy way of saying people with gun crimes should be forced to spend a minimum amount of time in prison, that the gun consequences for illegally using a gun are too lax in Illinois. And so he's saying that he wants a special session on this. There's many reasons that has not passed in previous years.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I remember I covering this a couple of years ago, Jamie, where the Black Caucus and the Quinn administration kind of worked together to prevent this from becoming law against the wishes of the Chicago politicians because they were worried about the explosion of the prison population that would result from a cost perspective and from the further disproportionate targeting of minorities for incarceration.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to get just right. I mean, there's support in concept all around, but getting it to a place where it could actually get through the General Assembly, I mean, there was a lot of debate over how much it would cost the Department of Corrections, and that became a big sticking point when it was moving the last time around. There does maybe seem to be some folks willing to consider this that weren't the last time it came up. But again, it's like devil's in the details on those things. So.
Well, the NRA has opposed this before, too.
Hasn't Superintendent Johnson said that there's, what, like 1,200 people who are on the list, and these are the people most prone to be victims, most prone to cause gun violence? And so they've kind of identified who the gangbangers are. And I would think you should be able to tailor a law to bring in most of those people, and you might try getting them on not necessarily gun-related charges, get them on other charges, drug dealing, not paying income tax, that kind of stuff.
Of course, this also comes at a time when Governor Rauner has a commission working to reduce the Illinois prison population by 25%, and taking one of the things they're considering, they haven't settled on anything yet, is reducing mandatory minimum sentences, kind of going in the opposite direction that this legislation
would do. Well, what you would do is you would kind of target it. You would have mandatory minimums for certain types of gun crimes, but you wouldn't have any mandatory minimum. You might maybe not have prison for, like, drug use, treated as a public health problem rather than as a criminal matter.
All right. Well, unfortunately, it's a sad topic that I think we will also be returning to later this year. Time now for notes from the field. We have about 15 seconds each. Tony, I'll start with you.
15 seconds. I'll just say that the Chicago Tribune's, the Tribune Tower has been sold. And so that's a noteworthy element of journalism, the state of journalism in the city of Chicago, that it looks like Tribune Tower along the Chicago River will be turning into condos in a couple of years. And where reporters go, maybe there's a Starbucks nearby that they can has free Wi-Fi that they can file their stories out of. I don't know.
Yeah, not first. Also, would not be the first grand old newspaper building to be either demolished or cut up for other purposes. Jamie Dunn.
Yeah, on the criminal justice topic, the Supreme Court came out with rules to govern the decriminalization of marijuana. This, you know, signed into law would make possession of a small amount of marijuana just a civil offense with a fine. The Supreme Court said that civil offense category didn't exist until this happened, so they had to set up some rules for implementation. They have done that now.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the governor signed a legislation to prohibit part-time county board members from receiving pension benefits going forward.
That was very brief. I will end by noting that the man who was formerly number two at Chicago's Department of Transportation was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He's going to have to pay $2 million for his role in Chicago's scandal regarding Chicago's red light cameras. John Bill's 55 years old, and it's been an ongoing thorn in the side of a lot of Chicagoans, a lot of Chicago politicians, because people do not like paying those tickets. That is our time for State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Jamie Dunn of Illinois Issues, and Tony Arnold of WBEZ Public Radio in Chicago. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.